In your new book, you write, quote, "What matters to me most about these transcripts is that they're firsthand, authentic, untouched by the egocentric interpretations and subjective interjections of the cineasts and pedants who have been rewriting and critiquing film history." Did you have anyone in mind when you wrote that?
I must say I had any number of people in mind. I have long felt that somehow, first off, we've lost the perspective on film as the child of this century. It is so new, so infant, a medium, an art, whatever you want to call it, we're rushing the gun, jumping the gun, rushing the season, that we're just in such haste to get absolutely immutable principles and interpretations down that we're not really giving ourselves time to investigate, to think about. I myself, having been brought up on, let's say, the absolute primacy of D.W. Griffith, I have come to find that he is not, that I no longer include Birth of a Nation, say, on my, somewhere in my head, list of the great films of all time.
When did that come off the list?
Well, when I began realizing that much the way we regard Pamela as the first English novel, we do not think of it as one of the great English novels. So I decided in my own head. Now, this is my own judgment. This is in my own hall. And I think that perhaps well after the year 2000, we'll be able to get some perspective on what the fine films are and so on. And it was with that in mind that I have said, and look, wait a minute, who's doing all this interpreting? I myself as a critic have interpreted something I have seen on film and been wrong about it. Let's hear it from the person who did it while he is still alive, while he is in his prime, while he is working. Let's see what he was doing, wanted to do, and why. After that, we can all judge whether he succeeded or did not succeed. But let's hear it from the first mouthers rather than first-handers.
How would you describe your style of film criticism?
Well, I think I have developed a populist style of film criticism. I am really on the side of the viewer. I am not on the side primarily of the filmmaker. I'm not an auteurist. I feel that the men I admire are human, that they can err. I think that Hitchcock made bad movies as well as good movies. I think everyone has. Therefore, I consider myself a delegate of the viewer. In a sense, certainly, with theatrical films today, a consumer's guide, in part. I think that's a primary function. Not only is money a consideration today, but I think that time is an even greater consideration. I think of my own time. I think of my life disappearing 2 hours at a time.
So primarily you want to be a consumer guide for your readers.
Well, I think that's a primary function of the critic. The second is to have, and it is James Agee's established rule, to have a conversation between moviegoers rather than a setting down of the absolute truth of perception. I've come to realize over the years, I've been a film critic now for 21 years, just reached my maturity, as we say. I have come to realize that no one is the voice of God, that we're individuals exchanging opinions, that we see things in very individual terms. We bring our pasts with us. I call it baggage. What indeed is in a film is very much in the eye of the beholder. And what interested me was that time and again you have directors and writers and others at these Tarrytown weekends saying, well, if that's what you saw, that's extremely interesting. Thank you for telling me about it. I did not put it there, but it must be there if you saw it.
You've been running these Tarrytown weekends, which are famous now for 13 years, I think. How do you feel when you've interpreted a movie one way and the film director's there or the screenwriter's there, and he or she is telling you that the way you interpreted it really has nothing to do with what they had in mind? And also, how do you feel if you've thought really highly of their work and it turns out that they're a really disagreeable, unlikable person?
Well, that's the luck of the draw. To be crude about it, I feel like a horse's ass, but it's a wonderful lesson in realities to me. And of course, I'm the first to admit that I must point out to the filmmaker that he doesn't know what he's doing. Only critics really know what he's doing. But that, to me, has been the value of it, that I have really learned how pompous I and many other critics are. No, pompous is not the word. I think presumptuous thinking that we really know another person's intentions. And we have put our own interpretations time and again on things that directors and writers and even actors have done and intended to do. And, you know, it's particularly dangerous in film. The book critic sees what is there in black and white and can attribute it all to the writer. The play critic knows that it is the playwright and the director and, at worst, a runaway actor out of the director's control on the stage. In film, there are minimally 20 different categories of technician and artist involved in what you see. And who did what, and who intended what, and what finally emerges cannot be attributed to any one person. And yet we're constantly doing that.
I guess that's what the auteur theory suggests, is that there is one person who has ultimate responsibility for the look of a movie. But as you said before, you don't like that theory very much.
Well, do you remember a film called Torn Curtain,
mm-hmm.
With Paul Newman and Julie Andrews? And it was in preparation when I first met Alfred Hitchcock. Oh, I mean, you know, movie lover's dream come true. And I remember we had a discussion of it, and I knew who was preparing the screenplay, of a very fine young writer, Brian Moore. And Hitchcock said, I'm casting Paul Newman. And I said, come on, you know, is anybody going to believe that Paul Newman is a double agent? Because I knew the story of Torn Curtain. And he said, no, but I've already spent close to $6 million in the preparation of the film, and therefore I must have major stars, so that even if people will not believe that Paul Newman can be a traitor, and that was still 20 years ago, you know, when we still knew that the star was not going to be the villain. This is the way I have to go, because we're already $6 million into this movie. So there is your auteur, you know. And yet one could say, oh, how dashingly brilliant of Alfred Hitchcock to have cast Paul Newman, when it was a very pragmatic dollars and cents bit. And Julie Andrews, because she was had come off Mary Poppins.
Can you think of another example where you'd seen a movie and had interpreted it one way, and then after meeting the filmmaker at one of your weekends, you realized that you hadn't called it correctly?
Yes. It was with Butch Cassidy and George Roy Hill. And it was then I realized that the only way to cope with humiliation is to beat your breast a little in public. There is that wonderful moment. I still think that I saw it the right way. There is that wonderful moment in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, when they are guarding a payroll and they're attacked by bandits and they have a shootout, and the killing of the bandits is done in slow motion. And At the George Roy Hill weekend, a young man in the audience said, "Mr. Hill, that's what these weekends are for." He said, "Mr. Hill, I was very disappointed to see you to resort to slow motion during the killing of the bandits because I felt it was a cliché that you were using." And George Roy Hill said, "Yes, you're absolutely right. I did not so intend it. I was really planning. I had three cameras set up, and I was planning a stop-motion sequence. But unfortunately, the cameras were not set properly. It did not work, and the only way I could save that sequence, much to my own disappointment, was by putting it in slow motion." And I sat there just, melting with shame. And I said, "Well, let me tell you what Judith Crist said about that slow motion." And I whipped out my review, which I have at the ready, just as reference during these weekends. And I had written that here was the great artistry of George Roy Hill, who was, by the use of slow motion, telling us that while the Sundance Kid was a killer, Butch Cassidy had never killed before. This was actually his first killing, and how slow and horrifying and painful an experience it was as the slowness of death evolved, and that George Roy Hill was such an artist. He told this to us through slow motion as in A Long Day's Dying. And I said, "Well, that's what I saw." And in spite of what Mr. Hill says, only the critic really knows. So that was, and it taught me a very important lesson, that indeed, and it encouraged me in the Tarrytown weekends, because this was early on, indeed, if you can get the intention from the filmmaker, how much better for people to know that here, this was a mistake in technology that led to this, instead of, and I know that review has been reprinted in several textbooks and so on, instead of promulgating my myth that this was a great artistic interpretation of death.
Well, but what you're saying might still apply, that the reason why that scene works is because it conveys the emotion that you are discussing, although the scene evolved through accident, not through intention.
Yeah, that's very true, but I think it better to know that George Roy Hill himself did not approve of using slow motion at that point. It's his movie.
My guest is film critic Judith Crist, and she's just completed a book based on transcripts of the appearances of film directors and actors at the weekends that she holds in Tarrytown, and the book is called Take 22, Movie Makers and Movie Making. Those Tarrytown weekends were used in the Woody Allen movie, Stardust Memories. And I've been trying to remember if you're actually in the movie or not.
My character is in the movie. In fact, Woody had called. We have known each other since his early movies, and he had been a frequent guest. And to this day, even when he cannot come for a weekend, but he will, if he possibly can, let us preview his new movie there. It's a good test audience. He had called me and said, "Look, would you mind terribly in the movie I'm working on?" As you know, he doesn't talk about them at length. In the movie I'm working on, if I have the person originally I'd thought that I would have these movie weekends run by a man, would it bother you if I had them run by a woman? And I said, "It would bother me if you had a man. I mean, I think an actress deserves the role. In fact, why not me? I will play me." Well, of course, I couldn't play me because it would have involved 6 months in New Jersey, and I'm really not an actress. And Woody said, "Oh, would you play you?" And then we decided, no, this is ridiculous. And subsequently, he said, "But would you do a bit part for me?" So I had a line that somehow in the making of the movie was extended to about three lines in a nightclub scene where I am an onlooker who is watching the young Woody Allen do a juggling act. And I say, "Oh, the boy's a genius." And Woody said, "Keep going, keep going." And I said, oh, he's remarkable. It's just fantastic. That was my big moment in movies. And I must tell you, in case people care, I worked as a, I think it's a speaking screen extra, and I got $250 for that day's work. It was probably the most boring day in my life, except for the perhaps half hour when I was trying to hit my mark and really being a mess and saying the line 10,000 times. And I got $250 for the day's work. It went from 6 a.m. until 8 p.m. Not overpaid, but to this day I get residuals. I think last year I got $12.50. So one has a worthwhile movie career.
Don't spend it all in one place.
Right.
How did you like the portrayal of the person who's really like your surrogate in there, the person who runs the film weekends?
Well, I thought she was a very nice woman. And what I really liked about that movie, in fact, was the satiric view of the people who come to Tarrytown weekends. Of course, I would have liked Woody to do something about the nice, normal people who are the vast majority of the people who come to the weekend. But small doubt there, the loonies, the fringe people. And as a social satirist and a very funny one, he had every right, I thought, to satirize that part. It is not one of my favorite Woody Allen movies. In fact, it's among the least likable for me, simply because I felt that it wasn't a progressive movie. That he was once again saying, oh, God, how I suffer. I'm so rich and so famous. I was disappointed in the film as a whole. But I thought he got his little shivs in, because when Woody Allen arrives, there are the people who are thrusting salamis at him and saying, hey, remember when we were in high school together, and regards for my Uncle Charlie and all of that. It happens to most of our guests on different levels, but Woody, of course, is an extremely popular person.
To tell you the truth, I'm surprised that he accepts your invitations to come, because he has a reputation of not showing up in public places like that where there would be fans who would want his autographs and want to shake his hands and meet him. I always think of him as maybe going to Elaine's, but other than that, not showing up in public places.
Well,
except to play clarinet.
Yeah. He is a very good and loyal friend. And it was early on in these weekends that he came, gave of himself so generously, and came back a couple of times, mainly with new movies. We previewed Annie Hall there. We previewed Manhattan there. We previewed his most recent film, Broadway Danny Rose. The tragedy is, of course, that the tapes disappeared. But we've known each other since his very first film, and I was one of his root supporters. If a friend asks a favor, he does it.
Do you ever feel under pressure to like one of his movies in print, even if you think it doesn't measure up to his standards?
No, I didn't like Stardust Memories.
And you feel comfortable writing about that?
And I wrote about it, yes, because you give credit where it is due, and I did like the satiric portions. But I did, and I, of course, told all my readers that in spite of my brilliant screen debut therein, my first and last screen appearance, that it was not a step forward. That it was a static movie in many ways, Ersatz Fellini.
You've written for several different places during your career. Who are some of the film critics that you've felt most competitive with? You know, where, like when you were working at a daily.
Well,
you know, and there were other people in that same city writing every day about movies, too.
I, of course, felt very competitive with one of the nicest men I've ever known in this business, and that was Bosley Crowther of the New York Times. When I was a senior in college, I went to Hunter College. I was president of the English Club. And I, of course, invited Bosley Crowther to come and talk to the English Club, which he did. But, of course, I was, like most campus big shots, you know, ulteriorly motivated. And I went to Bosley and asked him for a job after graduation. And I shall in my lifetime, I will never forget. I said, Mr. Crowther, and I've gotten 90 such offers at least during my professional life, I will shine your shoes, sharpen your pencils. I will do anything. Let me go to the movies with you. Let me write reviews, and you just criticize them so I can learn to be a critic. And Bosley was very kind to me. He gave me a lesson in kindness to idiot young aspiring critics. And when I took to heart, he said, you know, there's absolutely nothing I would like to do more. But unfortunately, this is a union paper, guild organized, and I could not have you doing anything like that here without paying you. And it's impossible. But he saved my pride. I mean, it was the kind of dumb thing that young people do ask to do. You know, I will be your slave. Just teach me something. So much to my absolute, well, surprise, years later, I am suddenly made a film critic. It was about 18 years later. And I am up against Bosley Crowther. He was the critic for the New York Times. I was the critic for the Herald Tribune. And it was extremely interesting because we were two totally different people. And I loved Dr. Strangelove. He hated it. He loved the Americanization of Emily. I hated it. We saw things very differently, and I think that was good because we were extremely different people. But we didn't really feel, you know, competitive, I will cut your throat. I had spent years as a reporter competing with Times reporters, and that was competitive because you could get the facts and get the story. But in reviewing, what's the competition? I've got my readers, you've got yours. And it makes for interest, I think, in the marketplace to have a lot of different people reviewing.
Did he remember that you were the young woman who had invited him to speak to the English club and asked him for the job?
No, I reminded him. and he was very dear. He was a very nice man.
Why did you become a film critic? When did you start to fall in love with movies?
In my very early teens, we came to New York, and it was during the Depression. And for 10 cents before 5 o'clock at the neighborhood movie house, you could see a double feature, selected short subjects, newsreels, everything under the sun. And I fell madly in love with movies. I had a deprived childhood as far as movies went. And I went two and, if possible, three times a week, which in effect meant seeing six feature films. And my dream, the only thing that limited me was the number of cuts that you could take, both in high school and in college. I mean, how well you could play hooky, how many times you could lie to your mother about where you were after school. And the lack of money. It was an economic limit. My dream was to see all the movies that were made, to see them during the day. Anybody can go to the movies at night. But to go during the working day the thrill of coming out of that black movie house into bright sunlight. Again, anybody can go to the movies on a rainy day, but on the most gorgeous days to go into that dark, dank world of reality.
Weren't you programmed to feel guilty about that? That, you know, weren't you supposed to be playing outdoors?
Of course.
Be healthy?
That's why the sin was so absolutely pure, but how wonderful to be able to do it without sin. And by the way, one of the first professional reviews that I did was seeing, what was it, Sodom and Gomorrah, one of those Italian biblical spectaculars, at 10 o'clock in the morning. And it felt like as if you were eating an ice cream sundae and washing it down with Coca-Cola at 8 o'clock in the morning. It was a horrendous experience. But I wanted to be able to do that without the guilt feeling, you see. And then, can you imagine being paid for expressing an opinion? I mean, we who pontificated from the age of 8 on, to me, this is what heaven was going to be. So that's what I wanted to be, a movie critic. And as I am fond of telling the people who say who write me letters, you know, and say, I'm 15 years old and I want to be a movie critic just like you. Do I have to finish high school? You finish high school, you finish college, you go to graduate school, you get a job on a newspaper. And if your time arrives, and you, by that I mean you have the right publisher, the right editors, and so on, then you become a movie critic.
In your book, Take 22, in the introduction, you wrote, I was an elitist in my youth so that I could be a populist in my middle age. How do you think your tastes have changed?
Well, I used to take movies terribly seriously. I used to feel that it was an offense against mankind. If a movie were trashy, if a movie were trivial, I was in such awe. I sort of went from one extreme, from just consuming movies uncritically. I think I felt as a critic that one had to have extremely high standards, that this, and if you remember, suddenly movies had become film, and there were cinema studies suddenly. Who knew from that? I mean, we went to the Moon Pictures when I was a kid. I think that I had very, my standards were too high. I didn't allow for fallibility. I don't think I understood as much as I should have by then. There was really no way to learn. Only experience can teach you the fallibility of the process, how much is involved in making film, why perfection is not hit every time. And that is basically what I mean, that I now realize that when you are dealing with a mass medium, something that is manufactured cooperatively, that you have to make allowances for fallibility, which I did not originally.
How many movies do you think you see a year?
Oh, several hundred, because while there's been a decrease in the number of theatrical films that are released, there's been an increase in the number of films for television, for example, of made-for-television movies, which are really, in a way, the B-movies that we've used to see, that we used to see in the 50s and 60s. And so I would say it averages out to about 300 to 400 a year.
Are there any generalizations you could tidily make about the difference between made-for-TV movies and feature commercial releases now?
Oh, yes.
Theatrical releases.
Yeah, beyond the obvious. One movie is intended to be seen on a screen that is 30 feet high, and the other movie is intended to be seen on a screen that is 25, we hope. Usually it's 19, but, you know, a diagonal 21-inch screen or 25-inch, whatever. So that there is a total difference in concept of what will fit onto that screen. But I think in the themes, for example, in the subject matter that is handled, that the made-for-television movie encompasses the social issues, the social conscience, the fluffy romance, the non-star melodrama action movie, that the theatrical film can no longer, at a minimum cost of $9 or $10 million, afford to gamble on. If I were a young filmmaker starting out, I would, much in the Steven Spielberg manner, I would get my start in television film, because it allows you, in a way, the opportunity to fail, because you don't have to get your money back it's a prepaid venture.
My guest is film critic Judith Crist, if you're just joining us, and she's just completed a new book based on, it's transcriptions of interviews and discussions with filmmakers and actors that have appeared at her Tarrytown Weekends, and the book is called Take 22, Movie Makers on Movie Making. You know, I was just thinking that you're certainly one of the very few film critics of your generation to be a woman. And you started writing at a time when there weren't that many women in newspapers in general. And I think that that's, you know, certainly changed to some degree. Another woman who I can think of who's also been writing about movies for a long time is Pauline Kael. Mm-hmm. Do you feel any affinity to her, either in the way that you write or in the situations that you found? You've written for very different places. I mean, one's TV Guide, one's The New Yorker, one's dailies, one's weeklies.
Or New York Magazine. Pauline is New Yorker.
Right. But I just wonder, you know, if you've met at all? What you think
of each
other?
Yes, indeed we have. Mm-hmm. No, as a matter of fact, when we both kind of came into public, I became a critic in 63, and Pauline had been active on the West Coast. She reviewed for an FM station. She wrote program notes for an art cinema in Berkeley, where so many people tell me they were first introduced to the foreign film and so on. Very different experience from what we were having in the East, and certainly in New York. But at that time, there were, in fact, two very well-established women critics. One was Rose Pelswick, who wrote for the Hearst paper in New York, and the other, although it was not her name, it was Kate Cameron, who was the New York Daily News critic. It was the name nom de plume for the film. Get it, Kate Cameron?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But
glad you pointed it out.
There had been a lot of women critics simply because movies were not considered terribly important by newspapers. And so, let a woman do it, friend of the publisher or whatever. Pauline and I came in at a good time, I think. We met. We had a little squabble at one of the film festivals. We were both on some panel about film criticism. And, I think Bosley, that Pauline had made some crack about Bosley. And I said, why are you worried about Bosley Crowther? The people who follow you are not interested in Bosley Crowther. The people who follow Bosley are not interested in you. Anyway, we had what seemed to be a squabble. In fact, the panel was arranged so that we would seem to have a public squabble. But we later met and talked, and it was a misunderstanding because out on the West Coast, no film got out of New York, no art film, if it did not carry with it a good review from either the New York Times or the Herald Tribune. Well, picture yourself being a movie critic sitting in California, and every time a movie arrived out there, it came with a preset review from either Bosley Crowther or Judith Crist. And if you happened to hate the movie, you immediately thought, those idiots, what do they know, and so on. But I would react in exactly the same way if I were sitting out where everything came with an imprimatur, you know, from those back east critics. So that was the source of it. Since then, we live and let live. As I say, she has her parish. I have mine. John Simon has his. Denby has his. Your Joe Baltake has his, you know.
Okay. Let's look back at the year of 1984, which is about to end. And I'd like to know, I know you're not finished with your 10 best list because there's movies that you are still waiting to see that are yet to open that you want to leave room for on that list. But what are some of the movies that stand out in your mind from this past year?
From the past year? You know, I had to search back because as you start your 10 besting, you say, will I be able to find 10 movies? And things like David Lean's A Passage to India and Cotton Club Birdie are movies that are still to come. But I thought back and I I think, extremely kindly of things like Broadway Danny Rose, Racing with the Moon, Greystoke. Anybody here remember Greystoke, that wonderful Tarzan movie? The Natural, Ghostbusters, The Bostonians, Henry James as Henry James perhaps should be on screen, a charming little movie called The Last Starfighter, a good Clint Eastwood with some depth to it called Tightrope, A Soldier's Story, Amadeus, of course, All of Me. I mean, a real good screwball comedy. Places in the Heart, The Little Drummer Girl, Garbo Talks, The Killing Fields, which is probably the most significant film of the year that one should see. It's not a great night at the movies. It's a harrowing film, and every adult should see that movie. So suddenly there are about 15 movies that are worth remembering.
She thought it was a decent year for movies?
Not a fantastic year. I can't roll off 89 years, but I can't remember really too many fantastic years. In these 21 years, I'm about to make my 22nd 10 best list, and I find it rather marvelous that it's going to give me 220 films that I would be as happy to see at this moment as I was when I first put them on a list.
Do you have a couple of lifetime favorites?
Oh, of course. I mean, they're all from my pre-critical days, too. I mean, there's so many, starting with All About Eve and The Maltese Falcon and Citizen Kane and on, and whether it's Horse Feathers or The Bank Dick or, The Grapes of Wrath, Gone with the Wind, Grand Illusion. One could start in on the foreign films. One could... Amarcord, getting more recent, Fanny and Alexander. There are endless movies. I would need a vault to hold my favorite films of all time. But I feel very much the way Joe Mankiewicz did when somebody asked him, what's the greatest movie of all time? And Joe Mankiewicz said, ask me that in the year 2020. He said, I know that people will still be reading Shakespeare. I know that people will still be listening to Beethoven. I don't know what movies people will still be looking at. And that, to me, is a very interesting speculation.
You've seen a lot of genres come and go in the movies. Do you get upset when you see a genre now that you don't approve of? And I'm thinking that, like many people, you might have been appalled at the appearance of the slasher movies, so to speak. But you've seen so many trends come and go. Does it bother you when one like that shows up?
No, because there have always been some kind of fringe trash movies. Live long enough and you overcome your embarrassment. I remember writing an article for Look magazine. Anybody here remember Look magazine? In, 1969, for the 1970 issue. What did I see for the 70s? And again, I was young and foolish then. And I said, well, of course, we've gone as far as we can go with sexual frankness on the screen, and the pendulum will swing. And we've gone as far as we can with violence, and the pendulum will swing. Well, the pendulum did not swing back. It just kept swinging on ahead. And every time you think that, oh, well, really, we've reached the worst, somehow there's always a worse to come along. I'm less disturbed now, say, by the slasher movies, because if you go to see them with their audiences, they're mostly young. They are kids who are so sophisticated about movie technology that, in a way, I'm sorry for them. They don't believe for a minute. They know it is hokum. And what they essentially are looking at is the state of the art of the horror film. They really are not caught up. This whole recent business about, oh, gee, Santa Claus, a psychotic killer. Well, first of all, nobody who still believed in Santa Claus could have gotten into that movie in the first place. In the second place, it is basically technology. When I was a kid, I thought that people really got killed in movies. I thought people bled in movies. You can't find a six-year-old who believes that anymore. Because of what television has shown them. One minute they're seeing so-and-so being killed. The next minute they're seeing him being interviewed on the nightly news. And so I don't feel that these movies are the ones that are going to ruin us totally and herald the end of our society.
Are there other movies that you think are going to herald the end of the society?
Every so often I do.
Like what?
I felt truly angry at and disgusted by Crimes of Passion. I just felt that it was an exploitation film because it was done by people of skill and people of taste. Yes, I can squint my eyes and say, oh, well, it's so silly, that too will pass. I probably would have been horrendously outraged by it 10 years ago. Now I just do squinch up my eyes and say, well, that'll pass too. By that I don't mean to be dismissing everything, but I don't find that so disturbing. I think that we are able to vent a lot of our feelings.
We only have a minute or two left, but I'm wondering, all the movie distributors know that your reviews are widely read. Do they go out of their way to send you anything extra in the promotional kits or to be extra nice to you in the hopes that that will somehow be reflected in a good review?
I wish they would. I haven't been offered a Cadillac in years. No, they don't. I have simply found that all they really do is either make their movies available to me earlier or they're not that dumb. Sometimes they just don't make their movies available until the last minute, if at all. Not really, because I think that movie producers know, as well as do the critics, that there really is no movie critic who can make or break a movie. My own feeling about it is that you can never kill the bad, and the best you can do is give the good a little push now and then. That's what makes it worthwhile.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Terry.